Shrink Wrap Radio number 437, Embracing Envy in Life and Therapeutic Practice with Dr. Josh Gressel.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Josh Gressel, PhD, who is a clinical psychologist and certified Imago couples therapist in private practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. He is also the author of the 2014 book, Embracing Envy, Finding the Spiritual Treasure in Our Most Shameful Emotion. For more information about Dr. Gressel, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Josh Gressel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really happy to have you on the show, and we're going to be discussing your recent book, Embracing Envy, Finding the Spiritual Treasure in Our Most Shameful Emotion. And I hadn't thought about it as our most shameful emotion, but that kind of makes sense. And so how did you come to take it on?
Well, you know, it was a couple of things. One of the things is I noticed anytime somebody would tell me that they had just written a book, I would find myself very, very envious and not really know what to do about that. I had this dim awareness that my envy of people writing a book had something to do with me wanting to write a book. But whenever I looked, tried to look up envy or understand it, I didn't find very satisfying answers. The answers were either very academic or very superficial, and neither one was particularly satisfying or helpful to me. So essentially, I thought I would kill two birds with one stone and write a book finally, and also get a better understanding for envy and what it might be about. There, I assume that there must be some deeper reason for it rather than just to make us feel guilty.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, I really identify with your story because I sort of had a feeling that I was supposed to write a book, that I should write a book. I'd been in academia for a long time, and many of my students had written books, and yet I still hadn't written a book. And in part, this was sort of a family message that somehow came down, that in our family, people write books or want to write books. It carried the burden of wanting to write a book. And I finally decided that I needed to get down off that cross, because really it was something that was giving me a lot of emotional distress kind of in the background somewhere. And then I actually had an opportunity to co-author a book that just kind of came to me without trying. And so that helped also to relieve the burden of that quite a bit.
Well, let me ask you, David, so when your students or other people would write a book, did you actually feel envy or did you just feel some kind of should going on?
I don't know if I can make a distinction between those two. I definitely think I've had some envy around the writing of books, and it still flares its head every now and then, but I've sort of rationalized it away, and this may hit home for you. With how difficult it is to actually get a book that's noticed, that publishers don't really promote them anymore, and there's so much work that goes into the writing of a book that I'm just not sure it makes much sense.
Yeah. Well, that's a separate...
Sorry to bring that up.
No. Before I get to that, what I want to say, the reason I was asking you first whether you were feeling guilty or whether you were feeling envy is, my basic thesis is that envy can be a real cue to us to help us direct our efforts and our direction in life. And we tend to envy things that I think it's not a one-to-one correspondence. Like the example I give of I wanted to write a book, so I was envious of people who wrote books when I didn't. That's real clean and easy and clear. But sometimes it's not so clear. So, for example, I used to be envious of people who were famous.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it was kind of bizarre. I'd be, you know, in the supermarket checkout line, and we're looking at the tabloids and see some Britney Spears or somebody plastered all over and be envious. And do I want to be Britney Spears? No. Do I want to be a pop star? No. What is this about?
Yeah.
And it took me a while, and it wasn't until really after the fact that I was able to understand that I needed to become more visible in my life. I was shrinking myself unnecessarily from public view. And so famous people were triggering envy, but not because I want to be famous, just because I needed to become more visible. So sometimes it requires more discernment to understand, but in either way, it's the envy. My thesis and my belief is that envy is worth paying attention to. And if we're, you know, so busy being ashamed of it that we won't admit it to other people, let alone ourselves, then we're going to be really be missing out on valuable cues that our psyche is sending to us.
And another thing that I hear in what you've said about your own story is it seems like it can lead to an action step. In other words, hey, if I'm not more visible or if I haven't written a book, well, what can I do about that?
Right. Now, and of course, for some of us, I think for all of us in some areas, the reason we haven't done it is because we feel like we're incapable of it. So there are some, you know, at a certain point, this is decades long that I've wanted to write a book and put it off. But at a certain point, I felt I can do it. Not everything do we feel like we can do it. We feel like for some things, I guess what I'm trying to say is we can feel more impotent. And the more impotent we feel, the more envious we will become. There's a direct correlation. I'm not sure if that should be an inverse correlation between, well, there's a direct correlation between impotence and envy, a sense of impotence and a sense of envy.
Okay. Okay.
When you feel more capable of, then it's more along the realm of emulation. You know, you look up to somebody and you'll want to be like them and you'll take steps to be more like them. That's a positive use of envy as emulation.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the difference between jealousy and envy? That's something you take up in your book. And what is the difference?
Yeah, that's, I think, a very important thing for everybody to be clear about, because in our culture, in our country, the words get bandied about interchangeably. And they should not, because jealousy and envy are not even synonyms. They're two very different things. Jealousy is wanting to protect what's rightfully yours. So, for example, if you see your partner flirting with someone else, you will become jealous because you want to protect your rightful, you know, your primary relationship. If somebody besmirches you in print, online, or, you know, on air and says something nasty about you, you will want to protect, you'll be jealous of your good name. Envy is wanting what someone else has that you think you don't. And the objects of envy can be as varied, as infinite as our desires, because there's so much that we can want that we don't have that we can be envious of almost anything. You can be envious of material things. You know, your neighbor got a new car. You can be envious of quality of life things. You know, your cousin got to retire and you still have to work. You can be envious of your, you know, your brother's children seeming more successful. You name it, you can be envious of it. What is true, I think, though, is that the more developed we become, the more mature we become, our envy gets more and more specific. You know, little kids are envious of almost everything, because they have a pretty undeveloped sense of self. The older we get, ideally, the more mature we get, the better sense we have of who we are, the more specific our envy will become. So you and I, for example, might be envious of a more successful psychologist, but we're not going to be envious, I don't think, unless you've got, you know, of a successful violinist or successful painter, unless you happen to be interested in that. Those aren't my things.
Yeah, yeah, I can definitely relate to that. The people that I felt some envy at times, you know, about people in my own field who are more visible, more famous, they're leading workshops all around the world, blah, blah, blah.
Right. I know that. But, you know, just let me take this moment to say that I'm doing, you know, a fair amount of promotion right now. And of all the interviews I've listened to, you provide a really wonderful service with the shrink wrap. I'm sorry to say I didn't know about it, but I've got to figure out some way I can listen to it in the car in my commute, because it's really terrific information you're bringing to the public.
Well, thank you very much for that. And yes, actually doing this has been, for me, a way to give a service to the world, but it's also been good for me just to exercise, I guess, that part of myself and to get that kind of feedback from people. And by the way, when the call is over, when our interview is over, I'll be happy to discuss with you how you can listen to it in your car.
Okay, because I've got a car that doesn't, well, we'll talk about it. I'll need to do that right now.
Yeah. Now, when you set off to write about this, you did say that partly it was motivated by your own experience of envy. Now, I guess you did literature research. And what did you find there? And did you also do interviews? I'm trying to recall.
Yeah, both. It was important to me to, first of all, know what was already out there before I set off on my own. You know, I did a pretty extensive literature review, going through, like, frankly, I got pretty bogged down in it. That was one of the crisis points of my my processes. I was, at a certain point, felt like I was writing someone else's book, because I was just doing this literature review and I was miserable and I thought it was boring and I was hating it. At any rate, the upside of it was that I really felt like I got a good exposure to what's been said. And then I wanted what I was doing to also, I think we respond well to story. So yes. I wanted to include people's stories, people talking about their own envy. In part, there's a meta message of this book is we shouldn't be ashamed of our envy. So I need to be upfront about my own envy as the author, and I like to share other people who are upfront about their envy to basically open the door for the reader to feel comfortable to look inward as they're reading this book about this topic that's usually hidden from view.
Was it hard to find people who were willing to discuss that?
Well, it was interesting. There was a very clear gender split on that. Huh. You know, I would say to women that I'm looking for people to talk to me about their envy and I'm writing this book. They say, that's a wonderful topic. I'd love to talk to you about it. Men would say, they kind of hem and haw and say, well, yeah, I guess I could help you out with that if you need it. So, in other words, I think as men, it's harder for us to acknowledge, this is a generalization, of course, but it's basically harder for us to acknowledge we feel incompetent or unable or incapable in some way, especially with another man.
Yeah.
So, men would help me by talking to me about their envy, but they wouldn't, you know, come out and say, yeah, I've really struggled with that a long time, and I'd like to really share that with you so I could better understand it. Whereas a woman would say, give me more of that kind of direct response.
Okay. Yeah, somehow that's not too surprising. Well, it's not surprising at all, especially as you explain it there. And women are just so much more willing to talk about their inner world than the average man is.
You know, you and I know that as therapists that's
sure.
True. Well, that's a side topic. I won't go there. But what I will also say is what I was surprised by with women, and I probably should have known this, I just didn't know how mean women could be with each other. I just, you know, until they started sharing with me some of their stories about, you know, the envious things. Like one of the women I interviewed was a former Miss Arkansas. And she said, you want to watch the claws come out. Just mention the word beauty pageant to someone and see what happens. And she said, it's not men. It's not men who do this. It's women doing it to other women. And she said, you know, we love the feminine. We love, you know, Mother Nature and the beauty. Why can't we appreciate a beautiful woman? She said, men can, but why are other women so, you know, catty and mean about it?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was an eye-opener for me to hear some of the stories that some of the women told about what they had gone through at the hands of other women. I was surprised. I didn't know women did that to other women.
Yeah. Now, earlier you mentioned the power of story, and I want to encourage you to throw in any other stories that come to mind as we continue to speak.
Okay, be happy to do that. There's actually, you know, it's now that you mention it, I found one of the most compelling stories that I put in there and extensively in there is I talk a lot about how our envy of others, how we need to use that as a way to better understand ourselves and our values and what we aspire to. But the flip side of that is we also need to be conscious of how our fear of other people's envy can limit us. And one of the most compelling stories in there came from a woman who talked about, she actually told two big stories. One of them was she had a mother who had three daughters by three separate fathers, and her father, the woman who I talked to, initially said he was going to adopt all the children, but in the end, the mother and him split up without him adopting the other two siblings. So she was the only one he came to visit. She was the only one he brought presents to. And she said what happened to her as a result of this special favored treatment by this father, what it did with her relationship with her siblings has been hugely impactful to her entire life. You know, that she's constantly an object of their envy, and she essentially had to move across country to finally break free of the limitations. She was just afraid to have anything too good in her life because of this primal experience that was, you know, a template that got set down in their relationship. Well, who do you think you are? Why do you get this? It was really limiting her. Now, far beyond, you know, whatever her father did or didn't do for her or give to her, it just had become this global thing that it wasn't okay for her to have a good life because of their envy. And so the story is very compelling. It's,
yeah.
It wakes us up to how we might hide our good fortune or not take steps that we would otherwise take because of not wanting to arouse negative feelings from those who are closest to us. You know, the role of envy in families, I think, is much more powerful than we appreciate.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, well, everything you're saying really makes sense. Now, you've got a chapter on envy, economics, and the politics of resentment. And I was surprised, you know, to see economics and politics coming into play here. So what are you getting at there?
Well, those are two separate chapters, so let me take them separately. With the economics, I mean, I think money is one of the easiest things to focus on, the easiest things to concretize and become envious for.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be really worthwhile to take a look at envy around money. And, you know, I haven't touched on this yet in this interview, but I certainly do in the book, is I believe in looking at everything that I can from a spiritual perspective, especially envy, by the way, because envy doesn't have a whole lot that makes sense about it logically, whereas other emotions do, such as gluttony. I mean, at least you get to eat good food, or sloth, at least you get to, you know, sleep in the morning. There's something that makes sense about those emotions. Envy's got nothing redeeming about it on the surface, so I think it must have a strong spiritual component. Huh. At any rate, with the economics piece, you know, you could say, well, we tend to think of money as being at the opposite extreme of the spiritual. But on the other hand, money and everything that we associate with money, whether it's, you know, the green pieces of paper in your wallet or your online statements or your quarterly statements that come in the mail, that's actually 100% faith-based. Those things only have value because of all of us agreeing we have faith that it has value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we know it's just in 2008 when the markets were tanking and everybody was starting to get into a real panic. When you when that faith is challenged, you know, the whole house of cards can come crashing down. So there's actually a strong spiritual component or faith-based component, let's say, to money. Now, where I think money is very different than the spiritual, what, you know, I want to be careful. I don't know about who your audience is. I have no trouble myself with God, but some people get triggered by that. So let's just use the more generic spiritual. For money to have value, money has value the scarcer it is. It's the law of supply and demand. If you have too much money in circulation, you have inflation and it goes down in value. Mm-hmm. So for money to be valuable, it has to be scarce. And so you can't help but be anxious around, unless you're like Bill Gates' wealth, you can't help but feel you don't have enough. I mean, it's just built into the currency. You've got to feel like there's not enough there for it to be valuable. It's just the way it's set up.
And you also need to have a group of people who don't have enough, it sounds like. That's one of the implications. Is that the case or not?
I'm not sure I'm following what you might be going off in a direction which I could agree with, but you're talking more in a political sense?
I guess so. I'm just thinking that if money becomes more valuable because it's scarce, then it suggests that it's no good to have an equal distribution because then it's not scarce.
You know, let's save that for the part when we're going to talk about resentment and politics of resentment, because that's the political. I think it's an important point you're raising, but I'm just trying to keep my own brain clear.
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
Don't let me mess with your brain.
Yeah. So where I'm going with all of this is essentially that this scarcity mentality that I don't have enough. I was very curious, how is envy, which is really predicated on this notion of not having enough, not being enough, how would envy play itself out in that realm? And so I interviewed two people from the opposite ends of the extreme. One was a very, very wealthy financier who lives in a mansion, you know, all the fancy cars, and a political libertarian. And another is a former leftist revolutionary who, you know, has aged in grade, but he basically still has very left-leaning politics, to really try to get to their views on economics and envy.
Interesting.
They both made compelling, in my view, they both made compelling cases. I can't tell you, I'm not going to be able to tell your listeners, well, you know, the libertarian was correct and the leftist revolutionary was incorrect. I think, or vice versa. I think they both made good cases for their worldview, and what I tried to do in presenting their views was really to hold a both and approach with what they were saying.
Okay.
So that's on the economics. Now,
wait, there must be something that you found, though, having brought up those two people. Tell us a little bit about what their view was.
Well, I'll tell you, what I prefer to do is to find the value in each one of them. The one who, the financial, the libertarian, the one who's basically against government intervention, against anything that smacks of government interference and redistribution, progressive taxation, you name it, he makes a pretty compelling case that when the government is given, one of the questions I posed to him is something like progressive taxation. And for anybody who's not familiar with that, that basically means is the more you make, the higher percentage you're paying. Mm-hmm. Not that it's just you pay more taxes, but you pay you're in a 35% tax bracket instead of a 25% bracket. I asked him the question, is that people's envy being given political might? In other words, is the government acting out the populace's envy? And his point is basically yes. He thinks, yeah, and he thinks that it's counterproductive. That, and you know, he cited a lot of statistics that if you take away I can't recreate these figures in my head right now, but that essentially you are destroying gross domestic product by taxing the wealthy at a higher rate, that it takes away from everybody and it doesn't really give anybody else anything. And it's just envy acted out in a political arena. And it doesn't do anything good and it does harm. Mm-hmm. So that was his point. What was interesting to me there is that he said anything beyond 25% of taxation does more harm than good, that there is a necessity for 25%. And that 25% figure showed up in another piece of research that would be way too complicated for me to try to do it verbally. It was hard enough for me to grasp it when I was reading it and reporting on it. But the point I want to draw from both what he said when that research said is that it might make sense for us to tax our abilities, tax our good fortune by 25% in order to live with other people. You don't flaunt everything you have. You don't rub people's noses in, like if your neighbor just lost his job, you don't rush over to tell him, I just got a big bonus.
Yeah.
That there's a 25% tax we all need to pay to live with each other. But there's 75% of our good fortune, of our abilities, of our gifts that we should be open about, that we should give to the world. And if some people are going to be envious from that, that's about them. You know, you can't hide your light under a bushel. I think that's from the New Testament.
Yeah.
You can't hide your light under the bushel just because somebody's going to be envious. Just one other point before I get to the guy on the left. One of the people who wrote the most authoritative book on envy is a man named Helmut, and I can't pronounce his last name, Schoek, S-C-H-O-E-K. He's a German, and he wrote it during the 60s when it was still close enough to that period when anthropologists were going into these sequestered jungle villages and studying people who had been living in an isolated way for centuries. And we tend to romanticize these, the people from Papua New Guinea or the rainforest. We think, they had these kind of stable and idyllic communal lives that were ruined when Western culture discovered them and, destroyed their culture.
Right.
And there may be some truth to some elements of that. But one of the things he said that they found in all of these studies across the board is that the fear in these closed societies, the fear of the neighbor's envy, what was usually be referred to as the evil eye, mm-hmm. kept those societies stagnant, that they were so afraid of stepping out of line of the norm that there was no real development.
Wow, fascinating.
And that essentially whenever those villages, which we tend to romanticize and think of in such idyllic terms, whenever they were opened up to Western culture, they very quickly either modernized or everybody moved away. People voted with their feet because people wanted to have a greater ability to express their individuality than was possible in those closed systems. So that envy really stifled development. I mean, I'm sure there were lots of good things that were happening in those villages, but I'm just focusing on how the envy can really stifle human development.
Yeah. Now, before you go on to the other guy, I'm curious if you remember, what was this guy who was doing so well materially? Did he share what he was envious about or who he was envious of?
You know, he didn't. I asked him... Actually, both the people, both on the left and on the right, neither one of them acknowledged envy. They were more talking about the financial implications of envy.
Uh-huh.
What he said, what I remember his quote was something about he does sometimes indulge in envy, but then he always considers that if he's envious of something, it's up to him to do something about it, and he gets off his behind and does something about it. And I will say I do know something about the biography of this person. he came from a, you know, some podunk farm town in the Midwest, and, you know, he had a, you know, kind of crappy farm town education, and through dint of his intellect and his hard work ethic, you know, he won a scholarship to a full scholarship to any university in the world, full scholarship at a graduate level. And he did his doctorate at the University of Chicago with Milton Friedman. I mean, so he really embodied the thing that he practices what he's preaching, I guess.
Yeah.
It makes sense that we tend to view the world through our own lens. So it would make sense to me that he would think, well, if I can do it, so could everyone else. He might not be as, I guess, open to how some people can't do what he did. And I think it might cause a certain blind spot.
Yeah. Okay. What about the person on the other end of the continuum?
Yeah. That was very interesting to me. He had a, first of all, it was very interesting to me. I'm not sure that I could directly relate this to envy, but because he was so openly in favor of communism and things like that, he has a very different view than those of us who have been brought up in kind of mainstream media. When he talks about Cuba or about Russia or about things like that, he sees a lot of the positive things that I wouldn't have thought of. So for example, one of the examples from Cuba, he talks about how in our American culture, we've commercialized absolutely everything. Cubans love baseball, just like we love baseball. But we have totally taken over our games with, you know, flashing advertisement, and the seventh inning stretch is brought to you by, you know, Lincoln Mercury or whatever. And he said, you know, you talk about envy, I'm envious of the Cubans who can actually watch a baseball game without all that commercial interruption.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, there's certain kind of things in cultures, pure things in cultures that we've lost that they actually have. Uh-huh. And so it's just interesting for me. But I think his point was that the point that I really took away from what he was saying is that he says very clearly, we're always going to be envious of abilities because there's always going to be somebody who is gifted with, born with abilities that we don't have. That we can't, you know, so long as we're human beings, we're going to be envious of other people's abilities. But his claim is that we don't have to be envious of other people's material goods if there's a more even distribution of resources. And, you know, his saying is that, you know, we call wealth redistribution is a dirty name in the United States. It doesn't need to be. And that envy, he said, you know, if you've got 12 people and 12 pieces of pie, you're not going to be envious of somebody else having a piece of pie because you've got a piece too. Just because, like, there's in our country, everyone's got access to clean drinking water. You're not envious of somebody having clean drinking water because if there's enough for everyone materially, you're not envious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the point that I think the point that he was making.
Yeah. Okay. And, well,
go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, well, maybe that covers the politics of resentment. But what were you going to say?
Well, you know, resentment and envy can be easily conflated. People will use the term "I resent" when really they're envious, but they don't want to admit they're envious.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, let's just say, you know, you're working in an office and you're co-worker got a bigger bonus than you did, and you'll say, well, I resent that. That's not fair. You're probably envious. You're probably envious because they're getting recognition that you want for yourself. And the real way to tell if it's true resentment and, you know, your co-worker got this bonus that you think you deserved as much, you would be more motivated to do something on behalf of, you know, you'd be motivated to do something like, well, I'm going to go to HR and I'd like a review of the policy so that we're all treated fairly. In other words, when you're resentful, you want to right a wrong, you know, kind of a civic wrong. When you're envious, you want what someone else has. And you just, you might call it resentment, but you're basically envious, pure and simple.
Yeah, I'm realizing that we really haven't defined envy. Now, maybe you just did define it in what you just said, but if you were pressed to give a brief definition of envy, what would you say?
Yeah, at the beginning when I was saying that envy is wanting what someone else has that you think you don't. And you can be as envious. I mean, there's just infinite things you can be envious of. So it's really wanting what someone else has that you think you don't. That's the definition I would give.
Okay. And there's some kind of emotional tone that goes with that, right?
Yeah, and you know that varies. There's different clusters, and frankly, I don't remember offhand. I did put it in the book because they did research about the different clusters of emotions in jealousy versus envy.
Uh-huh.
But what I do remember is hostility shows up more in envy than it does in jealousy.
Uh-huh. Now you've got another chapter in which you compare envy to the nicer emotions. And so what are the nicer emotions that you have in mind? And you know, what are you getting at in this chapter?
Yeah, well, again, it's really, some of this is just for precision and thinking, because in our day-to-day discourse, we tend to be loose in our language. And if we're loose in our language, we mix things together in our minds that I think it's better at least to have at some level a more precise understanding. So in that chapter, my memory of what I've got in there is competition, emulation, and this concept called mimetic desire. I don't know if you've got the book in front of you.
I do, and you got that right.
Okay. So competition is, you know, competition, I think, at its best is a spur to development through comparing yourself to other people who are also trying to succeed in something, you know, such as, you know, if you're running a marathon or Bake Off or, you know, just anything, a tennis game, that you pair yourself off against some other or others in order to really draw out the best from yourself. And so competition, I think, while it can lead to envy, I think competition in its own, you know, in its purest form is really just a wonderful way to further your development. Now, there are other people who will say otherwise, they say, you know, the zero-sum nature of competition, that there can only be one winner and everyone else is a loser, leads to acrimony and negative things. And certainly that can be true, and it often is true, depending on the people involved and how the thing is run. You know, we've all seen those parodies of, you know, the parents who come in and destroy their child's soccer game by the way they handle it, where the kids are out there having fun and the parents turn it into something ugly. But in its pure form, competition can really be just a real way to challenge ourselves and bring out the best in us.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, what comes to mind is a good friend whom I used to play tennis with, and he was a little bit better than me, but not so much better that it would have been totally discouraging to even engage and even try to play with him. Actually, he was very patient and kind of brought me up because in some ways he was teaching me tennis. But then we got to a place where we were fairly, you know, I was almost as good as him. Sometimes I could beat him, and it was exhilarating. We loved to play tennis, and I would say it intensified and deepened our friendship, if anything.
Yeah, and I think that must, you know, not everybody could do what you did. You know, some people don't like to play people who regularly beat them. They don't see the benefit, or they can't, maybe they could see it theoretically, but they can't tolerate losing. And it sounds like you had enough, you either didn't care that much about tennis, or you had a strong enough sense of yourself, or both, that you could really let this person teach you like this. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and I got close enough to where I could occasionally beat him, and so that made it meaningful.
You know, I'm remembering the first time when I was playing chess with my kids, and my middle son, the first time he beat me, he literally, it's almost like he floated across the room. He leaped so high in such joy.
Yeah.
So I can understand how it felt for you.
And that, I assume, was the first time that you didn't, quote, let him beat you.
You know, yeah, I don't remember quite how we played, but he that's true. He genuinely beat me. That was clear. He genuinely beat me. And the joy that he expressed, it was really something.
Yeah, that's great.
So the other one is, you know, emulation. And the example I brought in was from Judaism. In Judaism, there's this concept, the Hebrew is kinat sofrim, which is the reason I use this is because it translates literally as the envy of scholars. And, you know, Jews are people of the book, so at least in traditional observant Judaism, the person you emulate is the Torah scholar, the person who's really, really steeped in all the different facets of Judaism. And, you know, to really be grounded in Judaism, it's actually about the equivalent of 3 PhDs, you know, what you need to master. It's,
wow.
That's not hyperbole what I'm saying right now. It's really, as somebody who's now getting more and more involved, it's a little daunting to me how much I have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so kinat sofrim, or emulation, really is where you really see somebody who's so much beyond you, but inspires you to try to get to their level, or at least to reach for that. You see what's possible. Somebody who really shows you what you can do. I had something similar with a couples therapist that I once watched her work. I didn't know it was possible to do that kind of work. I just didn't know it was conceivable. And seeing her, I was really led to emulate her. Now, emulate is not imitate. It's a different word. Imitate is, trying to, all of us go through an imitative phase as we're learning something. That's natural. But emulate is, I think of it as more as you bringing forth the best you in that arena, not aping the other person. And the final concept, mimetic desire, mimetic comes from the word mimic. And mimetic desire, this is a French anthropologist who coined this phrase. He said, we don't, and this contradicts what I've been talking about, envy, wanting what someone else has. He gives a very alternative view that I'm going to give you right now.
Okay.
We don't envy what other people have. We desire what they desire. Now, that sounds a little slippery. What am I actually saying here? So, in other words, if you walk into your neighbor's house and they've just redone their kitchen, the temptation could be to think, oh, I envy their new granite counters. I want granite counters. What this man, René Girard, is saying is their desire for granite counters triggered your desire for granite counters. You can see this with kids. A child's playing with their toys, and they've got, let's say a truck off by the side. They're not interested in the truck. Another kid comes in the room and starts to play with that truck. Suddenly, child number one wants nothing so much as the truck that they'd left by the side.
Yeah.
That the second child's desire for that truck triggered the first child's desire for the truck. And what happens is this kind of cycle, this what he calls a mimetic spiral, that, one person's desire. So child number one then wants it. So child number two wants it even more. And you can actually see this if you ever bid in eBay. You start off with the price you want to pay for something. And as soon as somebody else wants it a little bit more, as evidenced by the price, you're tempted to up your bid.
Yeah.
It's a mimetic process, basically, where one person's desire triggers your desire. And that's how bidding wars, you know, get you to pay a lot more than you otherwise would if it was a fixed price. So this can obviously have some negative effects, this mimetic process. But he actually says that it can have positive things too, positive effects too. So let's say you go back to school as an adult, you get a degree in psychology, let's say, I don't know when you ever you studied, and your desire for leading, having a more meaningful career triggers, let's say your sister decides, wow, look what David did. I want to do that too. And so she would go and get her degree in whatever field. Let's say she goes and becomes a real estate agent or I don't know what. So that we can be also, we tend to desire what those who are close to us desire. So there's a kind of a community form where we're all desiring more or less similar things. That you can see this, by the way, if you've ever moved from one kind of socioeconomic neighborhood to another, you'll notice that your desires will go up or down in accordance with the people living around you.
Mm-hmm.
That influences us.
Yeah.
My wife and I we lived on a kibbutz, which is a communal settlement in Israel. We lived in this little two-room, 300-square-foot apartment. People would come to visit us from the United States and would say, you know, what do we need such big houses in the U.S. for? This is so much nicer. Now, they weren't envying us our 300-square-foot apartment, but they were desiring a simpler lifestyle that they were experiencing. You know, they could feel our desire for a simple lifestyle triggered their desire for a simpler lifestyle. So, again, these are other ways of comparing yourself or being influenced by the other, whether it's competition, whether it's emulation, or whether it's mimetic desire, that can have positive outcomes.
Okay. Now, there's another concept that you talk about, Schadenfreude, and you might, I don't know if everybody knows the meaning of that, so take us through that a bit and how it relates or doesn't relate to envy.
Yeah, well, some people consider Schadenfreude, first of all, it's a German word. We don't have it in English, but we all really know the experience because it means taking pleasure in someone else's misfortune.
Right.
We don't like to admit to it, but whenever we're envious, not necessarily when we're envious, let me correct that. Oftentimes, when we're envious of someone else and something bad happens to them, we take some secret joy in their misfortune. I consider it the kind of shadow of the shadow. If envy is the emotion we're least comfortable acknowledging, Schadenfreude is the aspect of envy we're least willing to admit to. It's, you know, you're really going out there to say, this actually happened, and I mentioned it in the book, so I'll put it on air. There was a friend of mine who, she's a published author, and she told me that her editor sent back her most recent novel with some devastating criticism, and she was just a mess. And outwardly, I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And inwardly, I was gleeful. You know, I was delighted.
Yeah, because?
Because I was envious of her, and her misfortune made me feel better about myself. Well, maybe she doesn't have it so good. Maybe she's not such a wonderful thing because she's got published books and I don't.
Uh-huh.
It's taking pleasure in her misfortune, that Schadenfreude, pure and simple.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, there was some other idea that was just flitting through my head, and I've lost it, that I wanted to ask you about.
You must be older than 50, David.
Yeah. Maybe it'll come back. You talk about the relationship between envy and social distance or propinquity, not a word we see often. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, social propinquity, I just love the word. It's a concept from social psychology. And basically, the concept is that we will feel affiliation with people who are closer to us, either geographically or in terms of blood relation. Even, you know, riding with somebody on the elevator or sitting next to them on the plane, this element of social propinquity comes into play. Now, you know, that seems, well, of course, but we only say of course because it's such a common experience. We oftentimes don't stop and ask ourselves, well, why is that so? You know, why do I automatically start to feel relationship because of proximity? And the flip of this is that, or it's not necessarily the flip, but we tend to envy those who are more like us. So like I said earlier, you and I would be envious of a psychologist. I think you said somebody who does the workshops or who's better known in public. I'm not necessarily envious of people who write books now, but I'm definitely envious of people whose books sell more, sell lots of copies, who seem to have an easy time. The way I've come to understand this is that we will latch on to those who are close to us because they are embodying something that we're trying to give birth to. And so we need somebody who's like us to kind of start our internal tuning fork resonating. In my case, it's, you know, writing a book. In your case, it might be, I don't know, the workshop or being, you know, having your radio broadcast more public.
Yeah.
It starts that internal tuning fork vibrating as you get into closer proximity. For example, you're more likely to be envious of somebody who's got this successful psychology radio program in California than you are in Russia. Now, when you stop to think why, well, it's just that proximity, that likeness that you can relate more readily. And so I think that we're drawn to those who are more like us or closer to us because we can use them as a spur to our development. That's why that works. I believe in that way. And by the way, lots of the famous rivalries, whether it's UCLA, USC, Boston Red Sox, New York Yankees, Stanford, Berkeley, you name it, it's based on geographic propinquity. There's a kind of closeness. I think Freud even said this at some place, that the most bitter wars are between the people who are most like or closest. So I think he gave, you know, England, Scotland, or, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland. We see it around, you know, the neighbors who are having these terrific struggles. It's the same principle, I believe, although working in a different way, of propinquity triggering something.
Yeah. Yeah, I went to the University of Michigan for graduate school, so I'm aware of the rivalry between Michigan and Ohio State.
Yep, and I'm an Ohio State grad, so I know just what you're
doing. Yeah, you would then.
So now you and I have to hate each other.
Oh. So you're a psychotherapist, and so I'm wondering about everything that you've fessed up to in terms of your own envy and everything that you've learned through interviewing and reading. And what bearing does this have on your practice as a psychotherapist?
Well, you know, I hinted at this earlier, and I'm glad I've got an opportunity to go a little more in depth in it. I'm starting to ask myself how much envy plays a relationship in families and in couples. That some of the toxic behavior that we are witness to, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be best attributed to envy. I'm not saying all the time, but for example, do we still have a few minutes? Are we okay?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I practice a particular form of couples therapy called Imago Couples Therapy. And the basic theory says that we will be attracted to and usually marry or get involved with somebody who embodies externally something that's dormant within us that we want to give birth to. So one of the most frequent kind of pairings in a couple would be the artistic, spontaneous type hooking up with the grounded, you know, responsible type. That's a very common pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And initially, it's very wonderful and liberating. You know, the spontaneous type feels safe and taken care of. The responsible type feels alive and joyful. You know, great. This is wonderful. What happens, however, once, you know, either you get married or you move in together or you make this commitment, is what was initially attraction becomes the point of greatest contention. You start to hate the person for the thing that you initially fell in love with them for. What we believe the reason is because you cannot outsource to your partner that quality. You have to own it within yourself and bring it out. And trying to let your partner do it doesn't work. So the spontaneous person suddenly becomes irresponsible in the other person's eyes, and the responsible person suddenly becomes this wet blanket who, you know, just ruins the fun in anything in the spontaneous person's eyes.
And this also fits really well with Jungian theory, right? And I believe you are very drawn to the Jungian perspective yourself.
I am, although I'm not quite sure how you would, what you're thinking when you say that. I'd have to hear what you mean by that.
Well, the idea, particularly when Jungians or Jung wrote about relationships and the whole process of projection and the whole process of being blind to one's own good qualities, let's say, and seeing them in another.
Yes, and absolutely. And I would add to that another Jungian concept is that the object of marriage and couplehood is not happiness, but wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
If that's right. What you're really about.
Yeah.
So where I'm starting to wonder if envy doesn't fit in here, let's just say I'm the partner who's the responsible one, and my wife is the one who knows how to have fun and who's the creative, spontaneous one. And initially that feels wonderful, and afterward I start to feel like I've got to do all the work around here. And why? You know, essentially what I wonder about is that feeling, that resentment that I feel, if it's not based on envy, why do you get to do that and I can't? Why do you get to have fun and I have to work so hard? I wonder if envy wouldn't be the best depiction of that emotion. And, you know, what's necessary in this example, like in every other one, is that I take responsibility. Well, no one's telling you you can't have fun, speaking to myself. No one's telling mm-hmm. you have to work so hard. You're doing this to yourself. Don't get angry at your partner for it. Take ownership. If, you know, so basically, I'm just starting to just kind of use that envy lens to better understand some things that I've been looking at for a long time.
You know, there's another sort of Jungian key here, I realize, in the subtitle of your book, Finding the Spiritual Treasure in Our Most Shameful Emotion, and the idea of that that there's value in what has been devalued, that the diamonds, the gold, are in the area of the shadow.
Absolutely, 100%. Thank you for bringing that in. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially because I do believe that envy is our most shameful emotion, it's got the most gold because it's our darkest place. So that's really a lot of what I wanted to do in this book, is to walk into that darkness and find redemption.
Yeah. Well, that could be a good wrap-up right there, but let me give you the opportunity to ask if there's anything else that you'd like to say by way of closing off the interview that maybe we didn't get to, or that comes to mind to you now.
No, I really, you know, obviously I turn to you because, you know, I want to bring this book to public awareness. I hope to sell more copies, et cetera, but I'm feeling a real appreciation for you for doing this kind of work, because I'm imagining it can't actually pay in any kind of financial way, but it's, I guess I want to recognize someone's labor of love and tell you that I appreciate it and thank you on behalf of all the people that you're doing this for.
Well, thank you very much. And I do get a little money. I do ask people to make donations, and they're probably really tired of hearing me make a pitch for that. But that really is only a small part of it. It's more the kind of appreciation that you're expressing right now that really is a very gratifying and helps to keep my engine running.
I was just going to say that I think, you know, this is still connected to envy. It's easy for us who are trying to do the right thing and not getting the mega recognition to become envious and to wonder what mm-hmm. that's about. So I really think it's important to take these kind of opportunities where I really do feel that appreciation that I expressed and let you know that I see it.
Great. I really appreciate that. So Dr. Josh Gressel, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, I have to salute Dr. Josh Gressel for his courage in facing his own shadow and being willing to examine and share with us his personal examples of the sometimes shameful and denied emotion of envy. I also admire him for transmuting the dross of envying others for the books they've written into the golden action of writing his own book. In this regard, he sets a fine example for all of us. It was hardly a surprise to learn later in the interview that he has applied himself to Jewish scholarship, inasmuch as his parsing of the nuances of envy comes across as Talmudic in its detail and precision. However, this is not to say that his treatment of envy is tedious or unreadable. Rather, it underscores a deep level of caring for both the topic and his audience. I find that Dr. Josh Gressel writes very compellingly about this emotion that often goes unexamined in his book, Embracing Envy, Finding the Spiritual Treasure in Our Most Shameful Emotion. And as always, let me remind you that you can order it using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Russell from New South Wales, Australia. You asked me to put together just a quick note to say why I was happy to support Shrink Wrap Radio. I discovered these podcasts totally by accident a few months ago and been systematically working my way through them. I was looking for ways to increase my educational experience and content whilst traveling to and from work, and stumbled upon your podcast, quite by chance. I've been blown away by the breadth and sophistication and the richness of the educational resource that you've got going there, Dave, and really is a tribute to your hard work and dedication. I think, like someone else may have said in the past on one of your previous podcasts, for me, the thought of you not doing this work through financial constraints was, a big motivator for me to put my hand in my pocket. So keep up the good work, Dave. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Russell Davies. I hope others are inspired by your commitment as I am. We have a new transcript on the site. It's Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 424, Being a Brainwise Therapist with Bonnie Badenoch, PhD. And that's thanks to Matt Dolitz of the very fine online journal, The Neuropsychotherapist. If you're not a subscriber to that journal, you really should check it out. The articles and resources are all of stellar quality, and I'm proud to serve on their advisory board. You'll find a banner ad that will link you to them in our left-hand sidebar. Last time I mentioned that we have two new continuing education courses offered through the Zur Institute, and they are Holistic and Nutritional Approaches to Treating Psychological Disorders for 5 CE units, and Holistic Psychotherapy, Treating the Whole Person, for 6 CE units. Well, I'm pleased to add that there is a new 43-unit certificate course that includes the two previously mentioned, along with additional material. And that's Complementary and Alternative Medicine for 43 CE credits. And you can get full details about it if you go to www.zurinstitute.com/online_certificates.html. Or you'll find a link to it on our site in the list of online courses for continuing education credit that you'll find there. And remember, you can get 10% off of any and all Zur Institute courses using my discount code DRDAVE88. That's DRDAV88. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on a course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry. The 10 sessions of this course are spread out over 2 years. You can attend the 10 live webinar sessions, you'll also receive an audio recording of each session. You'll find the dates and other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. The cost of the course is $150, but you can receive a 15% off by using the discount code DRDAVE, which is simply DRDAVE. My wife gave me a book for Christmas that I'm enjoying greatly. Its title is A Spy Among Friends, Kim Philby and the Great Betrayal, and the author is Ben McIntyre. It turns out that it's also available as an audiobook on audible.com. Here's what the publisher says about the book, and I quote, "Kim Philby was the greatest spy in history, a brilliant and charming man who rose to head Britain's counterintelligence against the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War, while he was secretly working for the enemy. And nobody thought he knew Philby like Nicholas Elliot, Philby's best friend and fellow officer in MI6. The two men had gone to the same schools, belonged to the same exclusive clubs, grown close enough through the crucible of wartime intelligence work and long nights of drink and revelry. It was madness for one to think that the other might be a communist spy, bent on subverting Western values and the power of the free world. But Philby was secretly betraying his friend. Every word Elliot breathed to Philby was transmitted back to Moscow. And not just Elliot's words, for in America, Philby had made another powerful friend, James Jesus Angleton, the crafty, paranoid head of CIA counterintelligence. Angleton's and Elliot's unwitting disclosures helped Philby sink almost every important Anglo-American spy operation for 20 years, leading countless operatives to their doom. Even as the web of suspicion closed around him, and Philby was driven to greater lies to protect his cover, his two friends never abandoned him until it was too late. The stunning truth of his betrayal would have devastating consequences on the two men who thought they knew him best, and on the intelligence services he left crippled in his wake. Told with heart-pounding suspense and keen psychological insight, and based on personal papers and never-before-seen British intelligence files, A Spy Among Friends is Ben McIntyre's best book yet, a high watermark in Cold War storytelling, or history-telling. Close quote. So, if this is your cup of tea, as it is mine, old chap, and you're not already an Audible subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and keep, and with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, you don't have to get this book. You can have any one of their more than 165,000 other titles for you to choose from. And by the way, the book is unabridged. The audiobook is unabridged, and it is read by a Brit. So that gives it that extra edge of authenticity. And I have to tell you, it's as engaging as a novel and as far out in terms of the audacity of what went on as any spy novel that I've ever read. So I recommend it highly. And of course, there are profound psychological dimensions to it, so we can rationalize it and justify it here on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's it's all in your mind. Let us all remember, what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis, here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Exploring my spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind.
I used to play my various Shrink Wrap Radio musical pieces more often. I'm thinking I may have new listeners who haven't heard these pieces, so it's good to dust them off every now and then. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one, and it is from Susan, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. First of all, thank you for providing such a wonderful resource for so many years. I just came across your site while looking for CE credits on neuroscience and healing. Your interviews were on the syllabus for the course I eventually selected. I'm writing today to request permission to link to a podcast, the interview you did with Dr. Robert Scare. Neuroscience has been a passion of mine for many years. I've built up quite a following on my website, myshrink.com. I launched it in 2006 to help the lay audience understand how neuroscience was changing the face of therapy. Frankly, I didn't think it would take this long for these ideas to translate into clinical practice. I developed the Brain Coaching Program for Emotional Self-Regulation to help folks in therapy. The program provides practical guides and resources to teach them how therapy really works and to help them manage their emotions as they wind their way through therapy. I also developed a product for these customers that explains trauma from a neuroscience point of view. I would like to link your interview with Dr. Scare and include a description of yourself and the work you do. About a third of my subscribers are therapists or therapists in training, so I anticipate you would get some subscribers as a result. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reply or call me directly." And she gives her phone number in Vancouver and concludes, "Yours truly, Susan." And if you have any interest in learning more about Susan and her work, I would direct you to her website. Again, it's www.myshrink.com. A little close for comfort there, My Shrink versus Shrink Wrap Radio. And the episode that she was referring to is number 321, The Brain and Trauma and PTSD with Robert Scare, MD. And Susan, if you're listening now, you should know that I have conducted a number of interviews on the topic of trauma, some very good ones, and I have more on the way. So I hope you will continue to listen. And I'm always happy to give permission to people who want to make good use of the interviews. So you're more than welcome for that. And it sounds like you're doing good work yourself up there in Vancouver. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to Dr. Josh Gressel for sharing his insights into the dynamics and variants of envy. My next guest will be Dr. Dan L. Edmonds, and we'll be discussing his humanistic approach to autism and other mental states. So I do hope you will join us. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.